Water. Earth. Fire. Air. Months ago, all of us could come and go as we pleased, in harmony. Then everything changed when the pandemic attacked. Only the TV series, Avatar, The Last Airbender, a series our friends kept telling us about, would stop us from anxiously watching the news. But just when we needed to stream it most, it vanished.
About a year has passed since my cousin and I started podcasting about Avatar, and although we've all been through a lot in this past year, we believed Aang could save the world. And you know what? We were right. After ending the 100-year war, with the help of their friends, Avatar Aang and Fire Lord Zuko transformed the Fire Nation colonies into the United Republic of Nations, a society where benders and non-benders from all over the world could live and thrive in peace and harmony. They named the capital of this great land Republic City. Avatar Aang accomplished many remarkable things in his life, but sadly, his time in the world came to an end, and like the cycle of the seasons, the cycle of the Avatar began anew. This is Kin Folklore, Avatar, the Legend of Korra.
People of Republic City, welcome to Kin Folklore. We're back to explore the world of Avatar by delving into the complexity of its sequel, The Legend of Korra. I'm Andrea.
And I'm Paul, and we're cousins who podcast about our favorite fantasy and sci-fi television shows. You know, a year ago, we embarked on a journey to podcast about Avatar, and it was amazing. I had so much fun.
Before we leap into Korra, we wanted to reflect on what happened following the finale of Atla, and what brought the world to its current moment when Korra becomes the Avatar. Previously, we explored the search, and also the promise. The search answers a question about the mystery of Zuko and Azula's mother, Ursa. And then this week, well, gotta listen to find out.
Yeah.
And then this week, we're going to be talking about the Rift, which explores how history influences the current moment.
Kinfolk, you know we will have adult content. So if you're here for Lady Tenhai pulling a reverse UA, leaving Sokka yelling at the moon like, you can do that? Yes, Sokka, you can. And UA just stayed the moon. She did not reverse and go from spirit to, like, woman. Like, what happened? Anyway, if you're ready for that kind of content, you came to the right place. Let's get into it. You know where we start? We start with Team Avatar celebrating. It's always nice when those guys are celebrating. And
they
they're celebrating a lot, what'd you say?
They celebrate a lot.
They do celebrate.
They like a good party.
Listen, you have to turn up. Listen, I don't know if they celebrate enough. If you save the world after a 100-year war, You should be turning up. You know, we need to pop.
That's true.
Let's pop some bottles. Well, they're too young for popping bottles. It's not. Let's go to the Jasmine Dragon, okay? Jasmine Dragon. Let's get some tea. And you know what are they celebrating? They're celebrating the formation of the new government in Yudao, which includes two representatives of the Earth Kingdom and two representatives of the Fire Nation. Were there no, like, water tribe representatives in this group?
I don't think there's any members of the water tribe living in Yudao.
Yeah, that makes sense, because I was wondering about that. Okay, so that's you know, the Senate has chosen to, like, negate or ignore a whole portion of their society. It's okay. We won't hold it against them. We do that here.
The water tribe's a little bit like Washington, D.C. Yeah. It just doesn't have any representatives.
No representatives. let's take care of that. All right? Let's change that soon. So anyway, Zuko has remained in the capital with his family, so he's not, you know, going to be there, and he sends Iroh instead. He's skipping the celebration. Sounds pretty Zuko-ish. and at the celebration, Aang sees the spirit of Avatar Yangchen.
Mm.
Wow, haven't seen her in a while, right? So it's interesting, that she is the last air nomad avatar, but he can't hear her. When she tries to speak with him, he's unable to make out what she's saying. At the banquet, Toph tells Katara and Sokka that she's not sure how to continue her metal bending school. She could charge tuition to expand, but she wants to create something new and different. Toph, charge, money.
I don't know. I'm with her here. She wants as many people as possible to learn this new skill, which, you know, more power to you, Toph, for creating a whole type of bending and then wanting to share it. And she doesn't want money to be something that stops people. I admire that.
Okay, I'm going to stick a pin.
As a person who constantly works for nonprofits, I admire that.
I do too, but I'm going to stick a pin in that for later on when we talk about another person who happens to be a shameless opportunist as a capitalist.
God.
But let's move on.
And
I'm going to come back to that train of thinking. After a conversation with Katara, Aang decides to take the Air Acolytes to the site of Yangchen's festival in the Earth Kingdom. The festival has three parts: bowing to the sacred statue, then marching through a meadow, and where they have a ceremonial meal, right? So they do all three of those things is what the whole ceremony comprises of, and they used to do this as air nomads, you know, when Aang was, like, young, but he's still young, but when he was young in before
well,
the 100
years.
He was
young 100 years ago.
So. Yeah, he's like 100-something years old. So the statue of a woman does not appear to be Yangchen, right? But Aang insists they bow anyway. Toph flashes back and remembers all the ways that her parents made her follow oppressive rules because of tradition and refuses to bow to the statue. When the group arrives at the location of the meadow, they find a town with a factory instead. Yeah, it's starting. It is starting. Aang is appalled. He's like, why would someone build something like this with machinery on sacred land? Toph, however, is delighted at the prospect of something new. As the group approaches the factory, they get a whiff of an unpleasant scent. Sort of like what you smell coming up the New Jersey Turnpike when you're driving through Jersey on your way into the city.
See, I'm not going to slander Jersey. Just not going to do it. I don't want the Jersey folks in my mentions.
I'm not going at Jersey. I'm just saying that am I wrong? Have they not smelt that smell coming towards the George Washington Bridge? I'm just saying.
They would say that smell is on the New York side.
I mean, they could, but it would. You know what? Fair to Jersey, it probably is our fault because we do take a lot of stuff over there to dump. But that is not just like we take the New York Jets and the New York Giants and we dump them on the other side of the bridge.
Wow.
Anyway.
Wow. You know what? That's your team. I don't stand either of those teams, but you are well-documented Jets fan.
I'm a huge Jets fan, and we think, you know, listen, I've suffered, and as long as, yeah. Anyway, I digress. After a conflict with guards who want them to leave, they meet Sitaru. And these guards, we're going to get back to them. Sitaru's an engineer at the factory who offers the group a tour. He's like starstruck. He's like, oh my God, yeah. You're the Avatar. Oh my God, you're Toph. Oh, so he and Toph, because he knows who she is, I think a little bit, click immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And do they click? Oh, mm-hmm. Man. It's there's some chemistry. There's some sparks going.
Even Sokka notes it. He's like,
Yeah,
what's going
I mean,
on here with Toph?
Listen, Sokka, we're going to talk about that, bro. Like, you've been out here with Suki all this time, and Toph has definitely been, like, feeling you, and you've been ignoring this. So you don't get to be like, ooh, what's going on over there? No. Just go over there and stare at the moon, bro. So they learn the factory employees, benders and non-benders, are working together collaboratively between his uncle, Loba, and the Fire Nation citizen, and an Earth Kingdom business partner. The innovative facility is also building machines that can do the same work as the benders, although not as efficiently. Toph is excited by this, and when Sokka breaks a forklift, she repairs it using metal bending. This is where I have an issue, because they're out here making Sokka like he's inept with these machines. Let's remind everybody, Sokka built a freaking submarine. He invented the submarine in this world. He's going to be all right with a forklift.
It's true.
I don't understand.
It's really true. It's really true.
Like, he cannot be impressed with a forklift or not know how to work it. He built a whole machine that freaking goes under the water, goes, like, attacks a whole other nation. And that's just one of his many, like, machines that he's invented. He freaking is a master blacksmith that created a sword out of a meteorite. I mean, what are we talking about here that he broke a forklift? Did they forget who he is?
Okay, can I just come back to one point, though? Yes, Sokka built a submarine. Big accomplishment.
Yes.
Huge. But it was powered by benders.
That's fair.
His experience with machines that function on their own is actually quite limited.
I mean, the airships, are they... They're not powered on their own, right? They're powered on their own. Yeah, that's probably...
Are they? Or, well, I think that the machinist and Sokka figured out a way to make them powered on their own, because it definitely didn't use... I think that...
Oh, when they find that gas. You're right. Wow. Maybe that's
the
part...
The Fire Nation airships are probably kept... Like, the firebending is used, but Sokka's... I think it is powered on its own.
Yeah, all I'm saying is he's not new to this machine life, but you do make a good point that he has used benders as power for the machine. Okay, so we'll leave it at that, but I was a little salty because I feel like they're trying to play my boy over here, my boy Sokka. So Toph and Satoru discuss the possibility of a collaboration between her school and the factory once she repairs his machine with metal bending, which could provide her with and expand the building of her academy. So, right? So there's a way now. She's thinking of doing something different. This could be a way that she's able to, like, do something different with her business model. Aang sees another vision of Yang Chen during this time and a giant creature destroying everything. He tells Satoru that the factory should not have been built on this land, and it leads to another argument between Aang and Toph, which is now starting to get pretty heated. Before the argument is resolved, they feel a rumble and then another. One of the workers gets stuck under the machinery, and Aang and Toph rescue him. Afterwards, they apologize to each other and kind of piece it out a little bit, right? Their conversation is interrupted by the arrival of Colonel Monkey and the Rough Rhinos, who were hired...
Ugh, these guys.
I know. Weren't they a singing group? Why did they just disband and become a singing group again? All right? Don't you want it that way? Don't you want to go bye, bye, bye? Get out of here. So they were hired by the owners of the refinery to be their personal security guards. Satoru's uncle, Loban, arrives wanting to know what happened and surprisingly is followed by his business partner. None other than Lao Beifong, Toph's father.
Wow.
Crazy. We haven't seen this guy since he was trash in season 2.
Man. And sent 2 idiots after his daughter. Just complete morons.
You know what? Thank God for them. Because this helped her become the greatest earthbender of all time. And don't you dunderheads forget it. Okay?
So, at the refinery / factory, Toph tries to speak to her father, who denies that she is his daughter, which was really difficult to watch. Yeah. He asks the Rough Rhinos to escort all of Team Avatar out of the refinery, and Toph and Aang refuse to leave. For different reasons, but they both refuse to leave. And a fight breaks out between the Rough Rhinos and Team Avatar. This fight is on two fronts because Toph and Aang also beef, but The Rough Rhinos basically get washed by Team Avatar.
As per the use. As like the, yeah, I mean, it has to be like, how many times has this been that they've gotten washed by Team Avatar?
Yep. And Aang is pretty annoyed with Toph because the way that she fights puts the rhinos in danger. And he's trying to model for his air acolytes who are still there. That you try to avoid people. Try to avoid hurting people every chance that you have. The fight continues down by the riverside where Sokka and Katara had led some of the rhinos. And Katara uses water to encase them in ice. However, one of the rhinos was legitimately about to throw a grenade. Ugh. Like, he was going to use a grenade against children? And now that the grenade, his hand is stuck in ice, he's holding this grenade that's been lit. And Sokka can't put it out. And basically it goes off and reveals a secret tunnel. Oh my God. I was like, I refuse to do it. But I'm not going to lie. When the secret tunnel was revealed, in my head I was like, secret tunnel.
Oh God.
So back at the factory, Aang has decided that he's going to take the acolytes into town to finish the ceremony. And they end up going to a restaurant that is owned by none other than the oppressed cabbage merchant.
Oh, the oppressed. He's out here living his best life with a restaurant. He figured out how to...
Is he? The restaurant is empty. He's struggling. And then Aang has the audacity to be like, we want to use your space, but we bought our own food. What kind of...
Listen, what the cabbage merchant is enacting that nobody else seems to understand is first mover's advantage. They just started the factory. He knows there's going to be factory workers there. It's empty because people haven't got out of work yet, but he's the only show in town. He shows up there and he's getting all their money after work, dining, breakfast. The only thing he hasn't done yet is create a food truck for lunchtime.
Okay. The cabbage man was trying to sell his cabbages in Omashu. What happened there?
We're going to get to that. Let's move on.
Avatar. Then the cabbage man went to Ba Sing Se. First, the government oppressed him. Then, when he was back, his stock was reloaded. He had, grown more cabbages. Then, what happened again? The Avatar. I'm just saying, Aang has been treating this man terribly through the entire run of this series.
Oh, you mean terribly, like, because of why? Is there a reason that he may be getting rid of the Cabbage Man at every turn? Maybe it's because he tried to get him murdered for knocking over a cabbage cart. He literally wanted them to get beheaded for cabbages.
Okay, fair. But his livelihood was destroyed, and that was the law.
It was not the... I mean, so, okay, cool. Let's just kill these people because they spilled cabbages over the... First of all, the Avatar... And Bumi did that. So let's just call it what it is. It's not the government that oppressed him, there were actual cabbage slugs inside the cabbage. When you freeze frame when the bear destroys the cabbage cart, there was a cabbage slug in there.
Okay, all right, fine. But when he regrows his cabbage stock, what happens then?
He caught a bad one because he's our mortal enemy because he wanted the Avatar to get murked and let the 100 years war go on forever.
Okay, you know who else wanted to murk the Avatar? Zuko.
Yeah, that's fine.
But we're not saying, is Zuko our enemy?
We're not saying.
Did we not just say that Aang should not kill Zuko in The Promise?
Yes, but he now doesn't kill the cabbage merchant. He just knocks over his cabbages. So he can like, have to he's like, listen, bro, this is for that time you wanted me to get killed.
He destroys his entire livelihood over and over again. I just want to say, and we don't even know how this is affecting the cabbage merchant's family. Does he even have a family? Does he have time for a family? He always has to work because every time he turns around, the Avatar is out here stalking him.
I mean, eventually he'll have a family, but at this point, it looks like he's rolling solo dolo. Like, looks like that's the case. I mean, at some point he will have a family, and we'll get to that, what happens with his family. But at some point he will have a family. But the point is that Aang ain't doing nothing. He just rolled up inside the cabbage. Right now he's like, he's even being kind. He's like, hey, we're going to sit down, we're going to have some food, and we want to meditate. Nothing wrong with that. I would say he should buy some food. He should buy some food.
I mean, they do. They buy cabbage cookies after the merchant is like, nah, you can't stay.
Cabbage cookies. That does not sound good.
It sounds terrible, but the acolytes seem to think they're not too bad.
Yeah, well, all right. We'll talk more about this cabbage merchant. I promise. It'll happen.
Whatever. Anyway, during the ceremony, Aang meditates, and he crosses over to the spirit world, where he can finally speak to Yang Cheng. She tells him that breaking the link with Roku is the reason he hasn't been able to contact her. As you may recall, Aang and Roku went their separate ways in the promise. She also tells him the beginnings of an important story. She recalls the memory of her first mission as the Avatar, and it was only a week after she had become the master of all the elements, and she traveled to a city that she was summoned because the city was being menaced by an angry spirit from the sea. While the city was being evacuated, she battled with the spirit all night. I mean, she really goes toe-to-toe with this guy. And eventually the spirit tells her his grievance. His name is General Old Iron, and he lived in that area for centuries with another spirit named Lady Tianhai, whom he protected. One day, a group of humans made their home there as well, and Lady Tianhai, who had become interested in them, became their guardian and entertained all their requests. General Old Iron was distrustful of humans and almost destroyed them, but Lady Tianhai stopped him and he left. He basically disagreed with her and left.
Took him out.
Over the centuries, the tribe became more and more powerful and grew. And the area became, you know, one of the most powerful cities in the world. But then a few days ago, Old Iron felt that Lady Tianhai took her last breath. And so he decided to enact revenge on the city. Back at the refinery, Toph confronts her father in his office. And they have a difficult conversation. Very tough. Like, she basically confronts him over the fact that, you know, he never let her be herself. And he's still sort of denying that she is who she is, essentially saying that she needs to approach him with more respect. The conversation is interrupted when Sokka bursts in and says that he needs help. After entering the secret tunnel, Sokka and Katara have discovered a secret mine that is essentially about to collapse. When they tell everyone to evacuate, the workers, which include Katara's old friends from the Water Tribe, refuse because they don't want to lose their jobs, understandably. Toph and her father follow Sokka, and a conflict erupts between Lao, who orders everyone to evacuate, and Loban, who basically says they need to stay. One of the guards throws something at Sokka, and it hits a support beam instead, causing the mine to partially collapse. Sokka and some of the workers are able to escape before the collapse, but Katara, Toph, Satoru, and some of the others are trapped. Still in the spirit world, Yang Chen tells Aang that she and General Old Iron came to an agreement that would be honored for all of eternity. To uphold her end of the bargain, Yang Cheng established a ritual that would become Yang Cheng's festival. Before Yang Chen can tell Aang all the specifics, he is disturbed by the rumbling, which was caused by the mine collapse. Aang immediately heads back to the refinery and tries to airbend a path out of the mine, but Katara yells to him to stop. Because the earth is highly saturated with iron, Toph alone is keeping it from falling on them.
Yeah, man. What a chain of events, right? So we're finding out a lot of backstory that we'll go over in a little bit. But back at the Beifeng Metal Bending Academy, which was previously introduced in The Promise, the classes are being taught by the Dark One. The dark one is an angel.
So much angst.
So much angst. So much. I look at him and I'm like, man, why are you so emo? It's almost like, you know, Panic at the Disco and Drake had a love child. It's like, what just happened? So he's an angry teenage boy. And Penga, who's an enthusiastic little girl, and also Ho-Tan, who's an anxious teenage boy. The class is interrupted by Sokka, who requests that the metal benders follow him. Back at the earthen fire refinery, Katara tells Satoru to give the last of the water to Toph. If she fails, there would be no point in giving anyone else water because, you know, they're going to die because everything's going to fall on them because Toph's holding all of the rock that is collapsing in the mine up herself. So Toph asks Satoru to stay with her and talk. What?
Well, okay, so we did kind of skip a part where she read him for filth about what a weakling he was because of how he acted in front of his uncle.
I mean, yeah, that is true.
I mean, she was pretty harsh with him. You know, she basically was like, you know, you were licking his boots. You know, she was very, very unkind. So she's feeling a little bad about it.
Yeah, so she's trying to make up a little bit. But I also feel like there's some vibes. I'm getting some vibes off of them, you mm-hmm. know? Like, mm-hmm. for sure. And Satoru and Toph, they start to bond over their difficult childhoods. And Lau approaches to apologize at this moment to his daughter. He tells her that after she left, her mother also left. And he went to Gao Ling to start over. Wow, so lost a child, got divorced, starting over from scratch as a businessman. So tough little run for the Beifong clan over there.
Yeah.
That was tough. To, like, you know, you don't see his perspective until you start hearing more of the story. It's nice to see them talking. And then Sokka returns with the metalbenders, who help remove the dirt from those trapped there. And once everyone's out, Lobon orders the Rough Rhinos to haul the uprooted ore to the beach. So there's like a bunch of ore inside of the mine, which is why they were even down there mining. They were trying to get the ore out of the earth, and he had them down there doing that task. So he states that he'll ship it to another refinery in the Fire Nation to ensure that Lau cannot earn any profits, because now he's pissed at Lau for trying to get people to safety. This guy is not the best.
No.
So Aang repairs his meditation beads by bending a rock into a new fire medallion for his meditation beads, and he attaches it. Upon entering meditation, he sees Roku again. Oh, they're going to talk after he wanted to kill his great-grandson and the whole thing. Anyway. No, it's interesting. So the old avatar offers him a hug. Roku tells Aang that his past lives can only advise him, but he must find balance between the past and the present to find resolution. Aang then speaks to Yang Chen, who finishes her story.
Wait. Before we get to Aang speaks to Yang Chen, I just want to say that I felt that my boy Aang here did not put proper respect on Avatar Kyoshi, who he has to say hello to before he gets to Yang Cheng. I understand there's, you know, it's a time-sensitive matter, but he's like, what up, Kyoshi? What up, Karuk? Anyway, Yang Cheng, we were talking.
Yeah, he like daps him up quick, like real quick, like quick pounds. Like, yo, what's going on? What's happening? Hey, Yang Cheng. I mean, what? He just skipped over? Oh, man.
I mean, I understand that Aang probably doesn't know Avatar Kyoshi as well as the fan base does, but it just felt like, man, that was a quick tap and nod moving on to
I mean, and she did literally save his life. Like, they were going to execute him at the Avatar Festival, right? Like, oh, you know, like they were going to get, they were getting him up out of here, and then she shows up and saves his life. And there's other, you know, there's other things, right? So he should have definitely like showed some more love, some more respect. She did talk to him, you know, that little chat that they had. That he was like, I knew I shouldn't ask Kyoshi. Oh man, little does he know, he may not want to ask Yang Chen either. But that's a whole other story for a whole other time. Let's see why, right? So Aang speaks to Yang Chen, who finishes her story. See, she promised General Old Iron, she would honor Lady Tenhai with a statue, and that the land would return to its natural state and remain undisturbed as a sign that humans could preserve the balance between their worlds, the balance between the spirit world and the human world. She also established the annual festival. After she died, the celebration became known as Yangchen's Festival, and the air nomads kept it faithfully until they were wiped out. Aang asked if the iron dug up was General Old Iron's armor, to which Yangchen lets him know that it was. When Aang returns, he asks Katara to ensure everyone gets out of the building and decides to see Toph's students for help with the armor. But he soon notices that the mask is missing. Aang knows that he must destroy the factory to restore Yangchen's promise. Satoru returns on a forklift and informs Aang that he saw Loban and the Rough Rhinos taking down the ore, which was the armor, to the beach. Sokka and Satoru go in pursuit of the armor. In the town, Katara tells everyone to evacuate, including the cabbage merchant. When he sees the forklift passing by, however, he brightens and he calls the machine remarkable. Such an opportunist.
It is remarkable.
It is remarkable. He did do a good job, Satoru.
Yeah. What happens next is essentially a multi-front battle. Sokka and Satoru fight the Rough Rhinos on the beach. Aang, seeing General Old Iron rising from the sea, enters the Avatar state in an attempt to destroy the factory. And at the request of her father, Toph and the Metal Benders start to try to stop him. Katara saves Sokka, Satoru, and Loban from General Old Iron, who has retrieved his armor. And Aang and Toph argue about the plan to destroy the factory. Aang is forced to engage in combat with both his friend and the spirit. When Toph sees that her friends are in trouble, she works with the metalbending students to strip Old Iron of his armor so that Aang can have the advantage. When Old Iron is about to aim at the students, Aang reluctantly deals him a mortal blow. And as he dies, General Old Iron challenges Aang on the role of the Avatar, who is supposed to be the bridge between the spirit and human worlds, but usually sides with humans. After the battle, Toph and Aang reconcile, and Katara makes peace with her old Water Tribe friends. Aang and Katara notice that the statue of Lady Tianhai has been destroyed and wonder if General Old Iron was right, that spirits have no place in the physical world. Aang meditates and he notices that several crane fish approach him. Lady Tianhai emerges from one of the birds and explains that after General Old Iron left her, she took a human form one night and ventured into the city. Marveling at what the humans had created, she met the city's leader, fell in love, and decided to stay in her human form so that she could marry him. After their life together, she took a new form. She tells Aang that Old Iron was wrong. It is human nature to create instead of dominate, and that she believes Aang will help create a civilization that preserves and protects as it grows, and spirits will always have a place as long as humans create one for them. 3 months later, Aang establishes a new tradition, a spirit friendship festival.
Man, so much in this comic that has implications both on the past and the future. As we talked about in the previous episode, there's often these themes in the Avatar world where you're grappling with both how the past has impacted the present moment and how this present moment will impact the future, which is much like life, right? But I think this little window into Yangchen and also how Aang is going to handle this has huge implications for Korra. Huge.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think there's a couple things here that are really interesting. So one is that we start to see what the consequences of not having the air nomads be a culture and society right away. In the past, we've seen how that impacted Aang personally, that his people were wiped out, but we haven't really seen how important their role in the world was. And that role, in part, was to honor the land and honor tradition. and also honor the spirit world. And so seeing the direct impact of the air nomads being wiped out on this pact that Yang Cheng made with General Old Iron is really important to the world, because we're seeing here the beginnings of the industrial revolution of this world. And that in part is also erasing the tradition of honoring land and honoring the spirit world.
100%. And I mean, and you really see, like, you know, this land will have this conflict with the spirit world and also with the past, what's happened, and also with what happens later for Korra, is all happening in the same spot. So this very spot that we're talking about in the rift has a lot of history around this divide between the spirit world and the human world. And this is part of what happens at the end of this comic, right? Not to go too deep, but there's like a need for this spirit friendship festival, because there the death of Old Iron and all that Lady Tin Hai is saying, this is creating kind of like a conflict between the way the spirits view the human world and the humans view the spirit world. And this has some history, right? There's history to this. Like, and we'll talk about it more in Korra with things that happen in Korra that kind of talk about the history of the Avatar, that talk about, and there's other things that happen in the Kyoshi novels that, if you haven't read them, I highly suggest reading them, because both Rise and Shadows will give this Rise will give you more context about the Hundred Year War. Shadows will give you more context, I think, about and when I say Rise gives you context about the Hundred Year War, it gives you context from the standpoint of the power vacuum that was created to allow for it to happen. And then the Shadow will give you more context about kind of like exactly what we're talking about here, is how the past can really impact a bunch of things that happen in the future for many Avatar cycles and many interactions with, like, you know, and for the next Avatar. So what Aang is doing right here is definitely going to impact Korra. 100%.
Yeah. And I think that it's interesting just to see, we don't often get a look into the life of previous Avatars aside from Roku. Mm-hmm. So I really appreciated seeing Yang Chen's story, and honestly, the way that she jumped into being the Avatar for like a week and then immediately wanting to jump into a mission reminded me very much of Korra. That's like Korra's energy right away, is like, I'm the Avatar and I need to be taking on a role as the hero.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what do you think is her legacy? Like, when you think of, just based on what we read in this comic, what we've seen inside of Avatar the series, there's things that I will leave out or kind of just allude to but won't talk too much about that happened previously in other content that came after, like I just mentioned the Kyoshi novels. But just in the content that everyone has been privy to with, like, the series in Korra, what we're reading in the comics, and the original series, what do you think of Yang Chen's legacy?
So I think I go back to the moment from Yang Chen, what she said to Aang when he consulted with her about how to deal with Ozai, which is essentially that he needs to prioritize his duty to the world over his personal beliefs as an air nomad. I think that Yang Chen comes across as a very selfless Avatar, that she understands that her role is not to just honor what she needs and her beliefs, but also do what's right in the moment for everyone.
Yeah. I think Yang Chen, I will say this, Yang Chen, who I've on record when we did our little like wrap up of saying, if I couldn't have Avatar Kyoshi, I would pick her as the Avatar that I would probably pick to go in to build my team. We were doing our whole, like, you know, battle royal kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think she, oddly enough, has a parallel to a character that I don't think I would pick for my starting five in like a fantasy war, is Ned Stark. I think she has a perception that everyone feels about her which has nuance, and she's not as monolithic as people think. And I think that if you go into understanding her from that vantage point, you understand her deeper. And what I mean by that is that Old Iron has a real actual criticism of her and all avatars by saying, you know, between the spirit world and the human world, you avatars always pick the human world. Like, you never side with us. And he has a real issue with that, and he calls him to account, because as he's dying, he wants to let it be known that that's how he feels. And, you know, this is not the first time we've heard these things in the spirit world, and it's not the first time that it's come up with the spirit world and the human world, and it's definitely going to be a common theme throughout The Legend of Korra.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's an ongoing conflict between the spirit and the human world, and how do I put this? I think that I want to call back for a moment to the first spirit we really met, which is mm-hmm. Heibei, Aang's close personal friend.
I'm close personal friends with Heibei.
So Heibei had protected this forest for years, and then that forest got destroyed during the Hundred Year War. And so as they approached the winter solstice, Heibei decided that the way that he was going to deal with this was to essentially kidnap villagers. Mm-hmm. And Heibei was very impacted negatively by the actions of essentially the Fire Nation, because they were the ones who had destroyed the forest in their battle against the Earth Kingdom. And he was really negatively impacted by it. It broke his heart. When we meet Heibei, he is a spirit that is so angry because the land has been destroyed. And that seeing the land destroyed also has a really negative impact on Aang as someone deeply connected to the mm-hmm. spiritual. So we know that humans' actions have influences on the spirits and can influence them profoundly. But the humans of this world don't really think about the spirits unless the spirits make themselves known by menacing. And I think it's interesting to think about that, because General Old Iron and Lady Tian Hai were minding their business, and then the humans came along, and Tian Hai sees what they're doing, and she sees it as creation, as something good. But Old Iron sees it as destruction of something that was already beautiful. And it breaks up their relationship, their friendship, and then eventually leads to her taking her final breath in her second form, which was as a human. And so I think it's interesting to consider how powerful the human actions can be on the spiritual world, but how little we see the humans care about the spiritual world unless the spirits make themselves known. For the most part, the humans just go about their day-to-day life doing whatever they want, and the spirits, who are really the ones who are keeping, we know from Yue that the spirits are essential to keeping the balance, they don't really think about the spiritual very much. And I think that's maybe because they don't have the same access. That will come up in many ways in Korra, that the decision to separate the worlds, which we'll talk more about when we get to it in Korra, had a impact on both worlds. But I feel that that they're telling us the impact on the spiritual plane was very serious. Like, it was one that was very difficult for the spirits to kind of be stuck in just the spirit world.
Yeah. And I mean, if you enjoy, I agree with everything you just said. And I think if you enjoy this world, I just encourage you. I know everyone, you know, is like, oh, I don't know if I want to read the novels. I don't know if I want to read this other spinoff content. I highly encourage anyone who loves the cartoon, loves Korra, dig into those novels, because I know that we like one of the things I can say is that conflict is as old. I mean, and we see it in Korra. It's not like it's like you don't know that, but you get some things filled in. It's as old as the time from the first Avatars. Like, that conflict between the spiritual world and the human world was from the beginning of this whole cycle, the whole way that this unfolded. And it there's numerous things that are hinted at, are shown in this specific comic, The Rift, that really, really have their roots in things of the past. And it's why the conflict where Aang is reaching for the past, but Toph is reaching towards the future, is really central to what they're going to create for Korra to clean up in the next, you know, when we get to Republic City and we get to her story as her being an Avatar, her reincarnating as Korra, as the, you know, Aang reincarnating as Korra. It's really a central part of it, that tug pull between the past, because you got to think, right? We're looking at the post-war world. We're looking at all the technological advancements that happened in 70 years or so when we get to Korra. And there's a lot that's advanced since we saw the forklift and the cabbage merchant gets all pumped up, to what happens, what we see when we first arrive in Republic City. And, you know, these are part of the challenges. Every Avatar leaves a little bit, like we said earlier in another episode, every Avatar leaves a little bit of a challenge for the next Avatar. And this is what is being developed mm-hmm. right now, honestly.
So. Mm-hmm. I want to talk a little bit more about the tension between Aang and Toph, because the rift in this is referring to both the rift between the spirit world and the physical world, but it's also talking to the rift between mm-hmm. Aang and Toph. So this is a very interesting idea to me, that Toph's main gripe is that traditions for tradition's sake is ridiculous. Don't just tell me that's how we do it, that's how it's done. Tell me why. And I think that Toph has a good point. Tradition is often used to keep some people in their place. In our world, tradition has been used many times to keep women in a certain place. And so I think that their conflict is interesting, but they come at it with, like, I can see their point of views on both sides. So Aang's point is that he wants to honor traditions because his culture is literally dying out. He's trying to rebuild a culture that has been missing from the world for 100 years, and those traditions are a big part of the culture, and he wants to honor and keep them. I think they're both right here. Like, I think that Toph is right when she says traditions need to be explained. We need to understand why we're going through these rituals. And the ritual should not be used to hold us back. But Aang is also right. We have to honor history. We have to honor promises that were made in the past. And we have to honor, you know, the meaning behind those traditions. What's truly interesting to me is how we see in Korra, the world is a little bit moving away from the traditions. The technology and advancement has pulled them further away from the way that the culture is in Avatar, which is more reliant on traditions and spirituality. And so I think that this is the first time we're sort of seeing that tug of war, that place of where some people want to be forward-looking and create new, and some people want to just honor the old. And I think both of those things can exist at the same time, but it's a careful, nuanced conversation you have to have about that.
I agree. I mean, it's and part of it too is making concessions for, as we'll see as we keep covering this before we even get to Korra, is figuring out how to balance, like, the tradition in the sense of, like, making sure that when you're moving forward, because this happens a lot in our world, right, with technology and things like that. The technological advancements from even our parents' time when they were young kids to now is vast. But it moves so quick sometimes that sometimes you don't really, the people inventing or innovating or moving forward don't always take into account the people who are not ready to move that fast. So the fast movement can sometimes leave some people, some industries, some ways of life behind. And I think that's where the tension comes in. I think that's what Aang is feeling. I think in some ways, that is where our boy, the cabbage merchant, in some ways is a phenomenal type of character, because he does represent in some ways the ability to be able to move forward no matter what obstacles are thrown in your way. Like, right, you constantly, just innovate. And he ends up in a total different profession and a total different thing by the time we get to Korra. And there's a lot to be said about that. But there's also some people who struggled, like non-benders. And what, how do I fit into the world? Like, okay, let's make machinery. But then benders start feeling like, are we getting left behind? Because we don't need, we're not needed, or we're not as strong as we once were. And there's some issues that will develop there. So there's always a need. What we're talking about is really deep stuff in a kid's comic, which is there's a power vacuum happening right now. There's an industrial vacuum happening right now. And part of the reason why the vacuum happened is because somebody got, a bender became so powerful that they tried to take over the whole entire world. And another reason why it happened is because humans who are also benders became so power hungry and got so much of what they want that they stopped paying homage to or caring for the spiritual world. And that all has a price. And this is the weight that you see Korra carry, that a lot of times she doesn't get a lot of credit for, maybe even in the fandom, that because we all love Aang so much, that this is not all sweet. Aang did not create the best situation, even though he stopped the war for her to come into to try to fix.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's an inherent push and pull between technological advancement and progress and the spiritual that we experience in our own world. And I think that we also don't, the way that the land is tied to spirituality here is one that I think, you know, predates a lot of human history in our world. But like that, the notion that in order to create something new, you have to destroy the old. So this refinery, this factory is creating something. It's creating opportunity. It's a whole village props up around it, right? And yet they're destroying the river. They're polluting the river. They're destroying the earth. They're pulling the iron from the earth. They're defiling this land that was sacred. And so I think that that is an interesting reflection of our own society, but also is an interesting situation for Republic City to be in, and is something that we see throughout the series, that Republic City is this very modern place where they fashion themselves as being progressive and free in a way, but not everyone experiences freedom. And the spiritual world is not one that doesn't have access to Republic City. And Korra herself struggles with the spiritual connection, which is a big problem for Korra throughout the season, which is that she doesn't have the same connection to the spirit world that Aang did. And neither do her people anymore. That becomes a big issue, that the water tribes themselves have disconnected somewhat from the spirit world. So I think this is the rift of the comics I've read so far, and I only have a couple left. I think the rift has some of the deepest themes, connections to Korra that we see pop up over and over again, which is just this push and pull between the physical world and the spiritual world, and which side is the Avatar really on, and how does the Avatar know what side is right?
Yeah, I agree. I think they bookended it really well, because I think the promise sets us up. I think the rift really sets up this thing that you're talking about the conflict between, you know, the progress versus tradition, spiritual world versus technological advancement and human world. And then I think imbalance really, really brings it home and drives all these points home. And I think the other ones have like little nuances about our favorite characters that like they're little tidbits. And I think I value each one of them for something different. But I do think that the rift, imbalance, and the promise really have some things here that ask some deep, deep questions about how we look at our own world, you know. I enjoyed it, I read the comics. And then while reading the comics, I'd already finished the first Kyoshi novel, and then I was, I finished the second one, not so long after finishing all the comics. And it just, it makes you think about a lot of things about how, I mean, our own country, our own world, how something that could happen hundreds and hundreds of years ago could still be playing out for us today, right? And I just find it very fascinating the way they've layered this world in that way. You know, one thing that's not, I mean, we all, I mean, anybody who you do a Google search, you can find is like, you know, the Fire Nation, that's a long lineage, like from like long, long ago, all the way to where we get to Zuko, all the way to where we get to Zuko's descendants. And to think, man, all of the events of one family have had a lot of impact on this world, a lot, right? Mm-hmm. So it's really fascinating to like see that, to see how the past can influence the present influences the future, and not letting go of traditions, like you said, honoring them, but also, you know, what pace, poses the question, what pace is too fast for progress, right? Like, what pace is too fast when you're learning something new, when you're developing a new government, when you're figuring out how to, like, you know, start a new job? How fast are you expected to move, you know?
Yeah. It's really interesting to me, just to see that we know that we're on the cusp of a new version of this society emerging, and to be looking at all the history of the world, and the past conflicts and how they influenced the decisions that Aang and Zuko and the others make, and how to move forward. It's really well done. I mean, I was a comics skeptic. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to do the additional homework, but I will say that having done it, I've learned a lot about this world, and it's put a lot of the things in Korra in a deeper context.
Yeah, I agree 100%, which is why we decided to do this, which was, hey, we could jump right into Korra, but there was something that was missing for me when I first watched it, and now watching many times, it's fine, but when I first watched it, I was like, wow, how did all this technology show up? Mm-hmm. What happened? And I just couldn't. It was such a jarring thing at first, and I still enjoyed it, but yeah, no, this adds a lot of context, and you know, I know I'm out here campaigning to people, but I will tell you, you want deeper context, read the books, and everyone, like, I'm telling you, it's that deeper context will come. Those guys are gonna be happy with us for promoting their books so hard. But I will do it. I will die on that hill. The other thing I guess it makes me think about is, like, you know, our very intro, right, is talking about, we talk about all this progress and how worlds change after big events and the past and traditions. And one of the things our intro talks about is how we've all went through this moment of, or, you know, continue to get through this moment of the pandemic. And now we're coming to the other side where people are starting to get vaccinated and things look like we're going to start maybe having some movement and more things opening up, and maybe we get back to some of the things that we were used to traditionally. But the world is going to be a different place than it was a year or two ago. It's guaranteed. Mm-hmm. It already is a different place. And it really made me think about it when watching this, like when we're forming our new traditions and our new ways of being and our ideas around how we're going to move our society forward, how to make sure that we honor the traditions and while moving forward into progress. And also, what things do we want to honor and what things do we want to let go? So it was like a real, like, cool thing to think about when you're seeing, like you said, in the comics, them on the precipice of forming a new world, that I think our world is going to be kind of a new world too when we come out of this thing and we all get back to some sense of, like, re-engaging with each other in physical spaces. I think it's going to be a different kind of thing.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that's a really interesting comparison. I hadn't really thought about it, but you're totally right. Like, what comes next, right? Mm-hmm. How do we move forward from this moment? And will we learn from what happened in the past? We're having a lot of different moments in this country right now. I know we have a few people who are listening from other countries, but we are in the United States. And just like the rest of the world, we've gone through a global pandemic, but also we've gone through a racial reckoning. Mm-hmm. We've gone through a transition of power. How do we build, you know, our country back and bring it to a moment where we can reconcile some of these differences that have been really highlighted. They were always there, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. have been really highlighted during this moment of crisis. And how do we also build a society with a better safety net, which is the thing that I've been thinking most about. Like, we had a moment of national crisis and immediately millions of people were out of work. And just another tie-in is that, you know, automation is a thing that has been threatening our economy and the global economy for decades. That the notion that your job can be replaced by a computer or a machine is something that I think our country has been dealing with for the last few years, but is going to be an ongoing challenge in countries where their human capital has essentially been in factories.
Yeah.
So this moment of like them trying to replace the benders with a machine, and we know that they get to that point.
Yeah.
In Quora creates a dynamic where now you have benders who are not interested in being heroes, are not interested in, essentially being like Team Avatar, who, by the way, are constantly looking for money mm-hmm. and food, mm-hmm. But who are now been replaced by machines and don't have that position where they were able to make means by using their talent to survive. And so some of them will turn to other ways.
What a good tie-in. The artificial intelligence, automation, machine learning, the tie-in to like how they develop all these machines and that it replaces the bending. And that idea, man, it makes me think, when we think of bending, we sometimes think of it as like, oh yeah, like this is like some special superpower. But, you know, not to get all hokey, but each one of us has some sort of talent or special superpower that allows us to, you know, use alchemy to create our lives, right? In our work, in our day-to-day, in our relationships, and the way we interact with our community, and to have that kind of threatened in some kind of ways. And I like technology, so not like I'm like, oh, technology's bad, but I kind of just feel like that is a great tie-in to like, how far do we go with this before it starts becoming too much in human beings? Feel like they don't have any other outlets, you know, where does that line end for our reality? So I think that's a great tie-in, Andrew. Wow.
Yeah, I mean, I think it comes back to Toph's point of view, which is we have to move forward. So our goal is to figure out how to move forward and to be compassionate at the same time. 100%. How do we move forward and let the technology create new opportunities rather than replacing people, making them feel unneeded. This is the challenge that we're having, but I think it's interesting to watch in a fictional story all of how all these problems arise and how they try to deal with them or not. And sometimes they can't deal with them. Sometimes you can't make everyone happy. And I think that Aang and Zuko have learned that in many ways the hard way. But I think that it's worth having a conversation and putting into context for sure.
For sure. Cool. Well, that'll do it for us for this week. And we'll be back next week covering the next comic, which is Smoke and Shadow. We may have a different kind of format for that one. But just want to just tell you guys, thank you guys so much for listening. Thank you all for listening and for engaging with us on social media and reaching out and definitely reach out to us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Kin Folklore Pod. We want to hear your feedback. We want to talk to you about the show. We want to talk to you about the comics and we're excited as we keep speeding towards episode 1 of Korra. Lots of good stuff ahead. So I hope you have a great week and we'll see you next week.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.